This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
That would mean we would cross pretty much every tipping point that's been devised, and we'd be on an irrevocable path to an ice-free planet, which would completely transform the conditions of life. You know, those scientists who spend their lives working on climate science, they are terrified.
We go to Australia now to talk with Clive Hamilton. He's a professor of public ethics supported by the Australian National University and the University of Melbourne. Clive is lighting up the media with a fantastic new series on climate denial, plus his controversial new book, Requiem for Species, Why We Resist the Truth About Climate Change. Clive, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's a pleasure.
People down under may know you, Clive, but I think you've sprung out as a bit of a surprise to North American audiences. When did your article in Scientific American come out?
It appeared last week, but it followed a series of pieces I had on the ABC website, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, so the public radio stations here. And it was a series of articles that ran over 5 days, which was really analysing and exposing the state of denial around the world and the sort of tactics, some of which were pretty grubby, that are being used now.
Why would you take on this nest of hornets?
Because I'm scared. I'm worried about the way in which the global debate, particularly in North America and Australia, is going backwards. We've seen a huge gap open up between what the scientists are telling us about climate change, and even in the last 5 or 6 months since the so-called Climate Gate scandal broke, the leaked emails from the University of East Anglia, even in that period, a series of new research studies have appeared which make the future look much more ominous and frightening, and yet we have a very successful campaign by denialists who are persuading the general public that climate change is either exaggerated or doesn't exist. And so we should be very, very worried about this fact, because if we're not going to take seriously this enormous threat to our future, then we really are in a dire situation.
I get whiplash when I try to follow the scene down there in Australia. I mean, we've had terrible fires I've read about, and the droughts and the floods. You think, well, surely these are the people that are going to get it if anybody does, and a new government gets elected promising big things, but then the coal exports keep on growing. What is going on in Australia?
Well, that's a very good question. When the Rudd government was elected, the Labor government, 2 years ago, after 11, 12 years of the Howard Conservative government, which on the surface admitted there was that climate change is real but refused to do anything about it. When the government changed, we all expected that Kevin Rudd, the new Prime Minister, would live up to his rhetoric. He said that climate change is the greatest moral challenge of our generation. And yet we've seen from those early months a constant process of backtracking, to the point where, particularly with the failure of Copenhagen, the government really wants to not talk about climate change at all. And what was most alarming in this country was the way in which the Conservative Party, which here is called the Liberal Party, elected as their leader in December a man who described climate change as absolute crap. So we now have climate denialists who are in charge of the opposition and therefore provide the alternative government and the alternative prime minister of the nation. But as you say, Australia is the developed country most likely to suffer the effects of climate change over the coming decades. We had a monumental bushfires, catastrophic bushfires, a bit over a year ago in Victoria with 200 people killed. So it really is a mystery, and I think it speaks to the extraordinary capacity that humans have to filter out or deny the facts when they're inconvenient or too frightening to acknowledge.
Well, you know, it only took one snowstorm in Washington, D.C. to knock over this whole climate scam. That's what we're being told. And even the Wall Street Journal comes out and says that ClimateGate has proven that there really is no problem. Unbelievable.
Well, anyone who listens to a climate scientist realizes that this is a terrible situation to find ourselves in. And it also reflects an astonishing degree of ignorance that people confuse constantly the weather with the climate, the weather being the day-to-day, week-to-week change in the conditions around us, the climate representing the long-term trends. And to suggest that one snowstorm or a bad winter undermines, you know, decades of data and climate science showing that the planet is warming and that human emissions of greenhouse gases are responsible for it is really, what we're witnessing is a sort of new creationism, in the sense that we have a whole group of people who are now politically and ideologically invested in denying the truth of the science. Just as in creationism, people's pre-established belief set is enough for them to repudiate a vast accumulation of scientific evidence. Exactly the same is now happening with the repudiation of climate change for political and ideological reasons.
Yes, I know. You know, I get in hate mail, I guess I could call it, or aggressive emails from individuals who aren't really connected to any company, as far as I can tell. They seem to have turned their personal disappointment and fears into net attacks. What can you tell us about the psychology of hate that has arisen around this climate issue?
Well, that's a fascinating question, and it's something that I led off with in the first of my five articles about the extraordinary rise of cyberbullying directed particularly against climate scientists, but also directed to journalists, commentators, climate campaigners, and really anyone who is worried about climate change and says so. But we've seen climate scientists in Australia, and of course this is happening in North America as well and in Britain, receive, every time they go on in public and say something about their research on climate change, an interview or a news article, they are generally deluged with very aggressive and abusive and sometimes threatening emails, mostly from anonymous sources. So there's a small but extremely angry group of people out there who feel personally affronted at anyone talking about climate change. And they try to bully climate scientists and others into silence. And to the point where some climate scientists and campaigners have felt compelled to call the police because they felt personally threatened by some of these emails. And I think it's a mistake to attribute, as some people have, this denialist campaign to the fossil fuel companies, as though those leading the denialist cause are really tools of Exxon. And there's no doubt that Exxon and the coal companies in the US in particular have been providing funding to right-wing think tanks in the United States and in Canada and in Australia and indeed Europe. And that those think tanks are very important at providing, as it were, the raw material, the disinformation that gets circulated. But really it's an ideological political movement now of a substantial number of ordinary folk who, for one reason or another, have taken up the denialist cause. And here in Australia, there's quite a close parallel between this denialist movement and the people who swarmed around a political leader who emerged a few years ago called Pauline Hanson. It was really stimulated racist fears and the concerns of those Australians who felt shut out by the process of globalization and ruled over by elites in the capital cities. And that's very much been the case in the United States as well. It's no accident that Christopher Monckton, the British climate skeptic extraordinaire, who's a superb performer but is unashamed to tell lies over and over again, it's no surprise that he should be going to Washington to address a Tea Party rally. There's a very close alliance between that sort of inchoate rage which comes from the far right of the Republican Party and the rage of the denialists. Those two political trends are really merging into one.
And we just heard from Professor Stephen Schneider that Senator Inhofe is wanting to charge him and other scientists of the IPCC with some sort of crime for lying to Congress or something. It's gotten bizarre to the point where you could see if the elections change in 2010 and the Republicans come back in power, maybe we could have a return to McCarthyism and investigations of scientists.
Well, the accusation of McCarthyism has been thrown around for many years, and it's usually a warning and an exaggeration, but here this is a truly chilling development that scientists who've been going about their work in a diligent way for many years should now become targeted by a powerful US senator suggesting that they should be investigated for criminal activities. I mean, it takes your breath away. But it's not just Inhofe in the U.S. Senate. In the so-called flyover states, those states in the central part of the United States, they're called flyover states because the people who live there, particularly on the right, believe that the rulers of the country just fly over them from the east coast to the west coast and always looking down on them. But some of them are now expressing this, that their legislatures are dominated by climate deniers. So, for example, South Dakota, their House of Representatives passed a resolution a week or two ago calling for denialism to be taught in South Dakota schools alongside climate science. And so, you know, that both sides of the debate, as if there were a genuine scientific debate. And the parallels, of course, with creationism are very obvious. The call to teach anti-science alongside established science. So it really, and when you read some of the debates that went ahead in the legislature around that, you realize that there's a monster on the loose associated with this climate denial organization. And I think it's going to get very, very ugly. And I hope that Inhofe's outrageous proposal stimulates people of goodwill to realize that this is something very dangerous and must be resisted from the outset.
Well, Stephen Schneider was rather sad that he hadn't had a lot of time to spend with the students in his classrooms because he's been having to handle so much of this, and we're seeing abuse of freedom of information requests and these government paperwork. It's a blatant attempt to tie up all the time of research scientists. Surely we can't let climate science stall at such a critical time.
Well, and yet that is exactly the objective of the denialist campaign. It now seems to be very well coordinated, and we've covered some of the tactics being used, the attack by Inhofe, the bombarding of climate science organizations with freedom of information requests, which are generally vexatious and designed to tie up the scientists and their organizations. But also, and this is another thing I talked about in my series of articles, there's now evidence of what might be called black ops by people associated or organizations associated with the climate denial movement. The hacking of the computer system at the University of East Anglia is a best known example. But there in Canada, at one of your universities, at University of Victoria, I think it was, there's a climate research center. And two people dressed as and presenting themselves as computer technicians attempted to talk their way in order, I assume, to hack into the computer there so that they would get access to information. In addition, in the United States, someone has hired private investigators to rifle through the rubbish bins of environmental organizations. They're sending spies in to environmental groups to disrupt and report back. So there really seems to be quite a systematic campaign of disruption, not only of the scientists, but of environment groups campaigning on the issue.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Clive Hamilton, you have a new book out with the title Requiem for a Species. A requiem used to mean a mass for the deceased, and I'm presuming the species you mentioned is us. Why did you pick this title?
Well, right about 18 months ago, I've been working on climate change for 15 or more years. And I've always recognised sort of intellectually that we face a very serious problem. But about 18 months ago, I picked up a couple of new research articles and one or two books that had come out. And one in particular set out the task that we face and what would be necessary for the world to do in order to have a reasonable chance at limiting warming to 2 degrees, which, as you know, is now regarded as dangerous. And the analysis showed that even with an optimistic set of assumptions about when the world's greenhouse gas emissions will reach a peak and the rate that they would decline thereafter, even if we make optimistic assumptions, let's say that we assume that emissions globally peak in 2020 and decline globally at 3% or so per annum thereafter, which isn't going to happen, incidentally, particularly after Copenhagen, but let's assume something happens and we do that, that would leave the world warming to 4 degrees centigrade. Now, 4 degrees centigrade is an average. It means 7 or 8 degrees on land, and that would mean we would cross pretty much every tipping point that's been devised, and we'd be on an irrevocable path to an ice-free planet, which would completely transform the conditions of life. And that's it in a nutshell. Now, that's the optimistic assumption, if you really look at and listen to what the scientists are saying. And then if you talk informally to climate scientists, as I have last October, for example, I went to a conference in Oxford in the UK, which was called The World at 4 degrees. And this is something the scientists have never done before, to actually openly contemplate what it would be like if the world did warm on average by 4 degrees, bearing in mind it's warmed by only about 0.8 degrees at present. And, you know, those scientists who spend their lives working on climate science, they are terrified. They see the situation as being so dire that it's impossible to see any international or national processes politically bringing about the sorts of policies that would induce this rapid decline, very rapid and urgent decline in greenhouse gases. And therefore, we are virtually committed to a transformed planet, which will be much less friendly to life, including human life. So I think that we really do, and this is what the book does, have to rethink the entire future of humanity. So that's why I chose that title, Requiem for a Species.
Well, if we're going to survive, there must be a route out of this madness. Do you have some ideas how we can get past the denial, the intentional blindness, and these reactive emotions?
First of all, I think we have to recognize that the debate, so-called, although it seems to be about the science, is not really about the science. We're now talking about much deeper ideological issues, questions of identity, and fears about, and conceptions about the future. So I think we have to shift the whole debate away from the science. Of course, the scientific evidence needs to continue to be produced and put out there in the public domain. But I think we have to understand that denialists are driven by something quite different, and that the general public wants to believe what denialists are saying. I mean, who wants to accept that we're headed for a very grim future and that it's going to threaten everything that we've come to know and love about planet Earth? And so the general public is sort of ripe to be persuaded that there's nothing too much to worry about. And so I think we really have to confront that as well. Look, I'm arguing in this book on the basis of the science that we just have to accept the fact that we are not going to be able to avoid transforming the conditions of life on the planet. That doesn't mean we should just accept it and do nothing, of course. I mean, in fact, I say we should be much more active as a result, demanding that our political leaders take the sorts of actions that it can at least defer some of the worst effects. And also starting to have a political debate about what might be called democratizing survivability, because as this climate disruption comes upon us in the next decades, what we'll see is wealthy people taking measures to try to protect themselves and ensure their comfort and future, and poor people, both in rich countries and in poor countries, suffering the results. And so I think it's a real challenge to the democratic system in those countries that have them to try to make sure that the burden is spread more evenly as we go into this different world over the next decades.
Well, Clive, as we wrap up, is there something that I've missed or a message that you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, only this, that in a way, what we're seeing is an unwinding of the whole Enlightenment project. We came to believe, we as humans, that after millennia of living in darkness and superstition, 300 or so years ago, we came into this period of light where the power of reason would allow us to consider, assess the circumstances we face and make decisions in our own interest. And what we're seeing now is a repudiation of the Enlightenment, because science, the greatest child of the Enlightenment, is now being overruled by deeper passions. And so it really does represent a very profound, I think, transformation of humanity, not just in our material conditions of life, but also in the way we think of ourselves as being. So we're really entering a new age, and we have to face up to that.
Our guest has been Clive Hamilton. Find his hard-hitting 5-part series on climate denial at abc.au.net and in Scientific American, dated March 1, 2010. And look for his new book, Requiem for a Species, Why We Resist the Truth About Climate Change. Clive, thank you so much for sharing your busy day with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
In the year 95, I'm kinda wondering if man is gonna be alive. He's taken everything this old earth can give, and he ain't put back nothing, whoa, whoa. Now it's been 10,000 years, man has cried a billion tears for what he never knew. Now man's reign is through, but through eternal night, the twinkling of starlight, so very far away, maybe it's only yesterday. In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if woman can survive, they may.
As we heard from Clive Hamilton, the world's best climate scientists and green activists are under attack. Now we will hear directly from one of them. Stephen H. Snyder is a professor of environmental biology and global change at Stanford University. He's a senior fellow in the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. Snyder has advised the federal government during the Nixon, Carter, Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Clinton, George W. Bush, and Obama administrations. He's one of America's preeminent climate scientists, one of the driving forces behind the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We'll hear an exclusive interview with Stanford's famous climate scientist, Stephen Snyder. His latest book has been frozen out by major media. His teaching has been harried by attacks from climate deniers. Snyder talks candidly about death threats and attempts by some in Congress to charge him as a criminal. Shades of Joe McCarthy as humanity reacts to the bad news on climate with more madness. The interview comes in a telephone conversation between Professor Snyder and one of the few independent environmental journalists left on this planet, Stephen Leahy of IPS, Independent Press Service. Dr. Snyder opens up with the news of his alleged crimes against the nation.
Life's been just a wee bit busy with all this, you know, being a criminal now.
I haven't heard of your status as a criminal. What's
you haven't heard that?
No.
Oh, you don't know about Inhofe. Oh, Inhofe put out a memo last week from the Minority Report naming 17 climate criminals, including Susan Solomon and Mike Oppenheimer and people like that. And the reason that they were criminals is that there's a felony called deliberately misleading Congress, and he believes that IPCC is, since we were testifying for IPCC, he picked the 17 who've done it all around the world and said that we're deliberately misrepresenting Congress, and he's calling for a Justice Department investigation on criminal charges.
Nah. Seriously?
So I immediately snapped back and said, I believe that the senator is the sole front runner for the new NEOMAC award, which is Bring Back Joe McCarthy. I sent that off to 20 newspaper editors and reporters, and I said, do you guys have the guts to cover this? I'm waiting.
So he really made this serious, as a serious allegation?
Absolutely. Just Google it. Inhofe, climate, criminal, put in one of my names, Solomon, you'll get it.
Wow.
The first three hits on Google.
That's crazy. What's going on down there?
The man's a fascist. That's what I've always believed. And he's funded by the fossil fuel industry. I think he's in the top 10 of their money. He's in a state which is oil and gas. And he's completely scurrilous about the truth. And he has absolutely no shame. There's no possibility of ever shaming Inhofe. So he's just playing the game. I mean, there's nothing he can do. He has no power. Justice Department won't listen to him, and the Congress won't subpoena. But what if the minority wins next time?
Oh. Wow. Nah. I mean,
they'll have to deal with it. There'll be legal harassment paid for by the U.S. taxpayers of the country's best scientists in order to promote his agenda of fossil fuel interests. Don't worry, I'm framing it that way everywhere I go.
Okay. This is crazy. Are we in a particularly crazy time here?
Yes. This is the worst I've ever seen in the 40 years I've been covering this. And that's because we're getting what I call the fossil fuel industry contrarian battle of the balls. They're losing the war on science. The only thing they have left is procedure, innuendo, personal attack, and harassment. And they're now in the lawyer phase.
Of course, attacking the IPCC is also a part of this strategy.
Of course. So there are four errors. They're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
How many conclusions in an IPCC? 1,000, maybe? I don't know. Plus or minus 500?
Yep.
So it's a 990 batting average?
It's pretty good.
Now, that doesn't excuse the errors, nor have I ever stated we should not have procedures to even lower the probability beyond that. One conclusion?
Yeah.
Four total? Give me a break. Yeah. Why is the media covering this as a man bites dog story? Why don't they at least give the batting average in the same article?
Well, that's what I'm hoping to do, because it is...
It's because they've lost their compass. The media, in my opinion, is no longer the fourth estate. They're just a business following a focus group-driven model of return on investment. And it's tremendously sad and also very threatening to the survival of our democracy if they are simply following focus groups, right? Titillation, no complexity, no anti-patriotism. Where is Ed Murrow? Where is Walter Lippmann? Even Barbara Walters. What has happened to the media?
I agree.
Are they entirely driven by corporate greed? I don't mean Fox News. Fox News is just a propaganda station. They're not even a news station. And to some extent, MSNBC. I'm talking about the non-propagandists who've been reduced to a business model of journalism. That's a deeply broken world in a complex democracy. It's the last chapter of my Science of the Contact Sport. Can democracy survive complexity? My answer is not without having the old media that I know and love. You know, where are they? We need them. You know, where is Woodward and Bernstein? He's quoting Inhofe like he's the truth.
Yeah, absolutely.
Science is not a democracy. You don't have an equal right to an opinion without evidence.
I don't understand it either, and I'm not sure where we're going.
In the wrong direction at high speed.
Yeah, and...
I'm sorry for this. You just asked me why I might not remember what your email was about, because that's what I've been doing for the last 3 days.
Well, it's similar. I wanted to talk about the IPCC, the review, the IPCC review.
It's great. I'm glad there's a review.
Okay.
The IPCC, when people look at the batting average in a detached, non-political way, people say, oh, my God, there's no other human institution that comes close.
But will that message actually get out?
If the report does it, yes.
And
of course the message will get out. But remember, we're up against a multi-million-dollar disinformation engine.
Mm-hmm.
Called the fossil fuel industry and the haters of government.
Yeah.
And that's what they're doing. They're spinning and spinning and spinning. I mean, Inhofe's, you know, it's actually laughable. Conspiracy theory of IPCC errors deliberately testified to Congress to defraud them. Of course, wouldn't stand up 30 seconds in any non-kangaroo court. But the point is, it's all part of a political strategy to cast doubt on the credibility of science. And why would somebody like Inhofe hate science? It's anti-creationist.
Yeah.
It's anti-fossil fuel dumping in the atmosphere like it's a free sewer. All the things that's near and dear to his heart, his politics, his campaign contributors, and I'm sorry to say his constituents, is what he's going to defend. So he's in a holy war to defend truth as he sees it.
Yeah, it's an anti-science agenda.
Yes, it's an anti-science agenda.
We're listening to a telephone conversation recorded March 1st, 2010, by journalist Stephen Leahy, talking with world-famous climate scientist Stephen Schneider.
Now, one of the critiques a year ago of the IPCC was that it was too slow and becoming too complicated.
There's nothing you can do about that. It's a creation of 120 governments. They're not an NGO. They do not have a board to talk to. They have 120 governments. They cannot on their own just decide to go out there and answer criticism. So what ends up happening is you get comments of individual co-chairs and the general chair, and nobody speaks to the IPCC but the 100 governments who just had a meeting and said, let's get a review and that'll speak for us. I think that's great.
That'll take time, though.
Yeah, probably 6 months.
And
meanwhile, the liars and spin doctors will continue to frame IPCC as dishonorable, and as long as the Fourth Estate is not the Fourth Estate and keeps quoting it without quoting the batting average, then what they're really doing is the bidding of the liars and spin doctors by inadvertence, by lack of due diligence. That's why I wrote Science of Contact Sport. I felt that the media is slipping out of its critical historic roles, my last chapter. And this has only made me even more worried than I was before.
Worried about the media.
Media's incapacity to be able to put context mm-hmm. on claims and just reporting everybody as if they're all entitled to equal status at the bargaining table when they're not. How many times have I said in my 40-year career that science is not a democracy?
Yeah.
Science is evidence-based. Law is not a democracy. It's evidence-based. That if you're going to sit there and establish in the media the claims of everybody, and then say they were right, these were errors, without pointing out the batting average of the plays, and then tell me, as several journalists have, it's not our job to do batting average. Yes, it is.
I agree. It is. Should be.
Well, they don't think so. They said, if we catch a senator who's been, illegal, it doesn't matter how many good things they did. They've still been illegal, and we have to point it out. I never said they shouldn't point it out.
Yeah.
But this is not about illegality. This is about the relative competence of advice. The metaphor that I use is, if there's a cancer drug which works 90% of the time, are they only going to focus on the lawsuits for the 10% who died? And they're going to forget to say that there's no other treatment that does better than 50-50?
Yeah.
I mean, not to do that, in my opinion, is to shirk due diligence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I believe the media writ large is doing, shirking due diligence.
Yeah.
Because the average member of the public will not look it up and is not competent to look it up. Because almost all the blogs are elliptical spin.
Well, that sort of raises the whole question of the role of the Internet in blogging as a device.
Role of the Internet?
Yeah.
I teach a freshman seminar, freshman sophomore intro sem, called Environmental Literacy. It's an anti-propaganda course.
Hmm.
And what I try to teach my kids is how to learn to discern the quality of an argument.
Mm-hmm.
Watch out for the mythbusters and the truth tellers and the ones with certain facts.
Yeah.
Listen to the apologists with, bell curves and ranges and ordering things into well-established competing explanations and speculative. They're almost always telling the truth. And the ones who know the answer and know who the villains are and all that, forget it. They're spinners. And once in a while, they're right. But most of the time, they're not. And that is something the public is exceedingly bad at.
Mm-hmm.
And the media used to do it for them because they had specialists who were gatekeepers of what information got released, and they put perspective on the relative credibility of arguments. Who's left doing that? Seth? Juliet sometimes? Haven't seen it out of Rosenthal?
Andy,
I don't know.
Andy Refkin.
How many are left out there
is retired
in the environment world working for the mainstream? Who actually is smart enough to be able to smell the north end of a southbound horse.
Not many left in North America, anyways.
Not in North America.
Europe is doing still
okay. Europe is better.
Yeah, except for the UK.
Australia is not very good.
No.
Almost all of them are in the ABC, in the print media, not many.
Yeah. Yeah, so what's the way forward there in terms of this?
I don't know. I write books on it. and nobody in the media, you know, I haven't had one book review in the mainstream media.
Really?
The only one that came close was Sharon Begley in Newsweek, and it was her blog on the website. Huh. Never made Newsweek. Every other book I have done since the Genesis Strategy in 1976 has been reviewed in all the major newspapers. I've been on national TV fighting and screaming, but nonetheless doing it. Not one national TV program. Well, not only one national radio program was Science Friday.
Hmm.
Nobody's interested. And when the super freaks went on, I don't know where it was today, Good Morning America, something like that, the publicist at National Geographic, where I work, mm-hmm. where my book is, that is, sent them an email and said, well, you just put on a reporter and a Chicago school economist completely misrepresenting climate science. Don't you have an obligation to put on somebody who is competent at it and also has a book? And they wrote back and they said, your client is just a scientist. Our guests are what our viewers want to watch. They are best-selling New York Times authors. He isn't.
Wow.
So it's a matter of whether you're a best-selling New York Times author, not whether you have credentials and whether you're right. That's the basis for determining who goes on Today or Good Morning America. Okay. That is such a deeply broken institution. I don't know why we have a First Amendment to protect a business in search of ratings. When are they going to do their job? As Walter Lippmann and, mm-hmm. you know, as I said, and Ed Murrow taught them how 40 years ago. It's a pathetic state of an industry that's become an industry instead of a fourth estate.
Yeah, it's,
and it's dangerous to democracy, in my opinion. Please, media, I actually trust them.
Mm-hmm.
Get your old legs back.
I agree, it's a dangerous
situation. I trust them a lot more in the blogosphere, but yeah. they've abdicated because they're so frightened about going out of business with the wiki model that they're becoming one of them.
Yep. Let's jump back to the IPCC. The future AR5 is underway. Is it going to be any different in terms of scope or...
Oh, the scope's already been done.
Yeah, okay.
And it's on their website. Right. It was a document approved at the Bali plenary by the 120 governments. And unless something happens because of all what's going on now, and the plenary, remember, the plenary is 120 governments, changes their mind, it's already scoped. All the scientists have already been nominated to national governments. They're all picking them. Nothing is going to change. It is possible leadership will change. It is possible procedures will change.
Mm-hmm.
It is possible the whole thing will change, but not likely. It's really not broken.
Analogies to the tobacco industry, this whole campaign.
Completely apt. There's a new book out on it, too. Talk to Her, from Naomi Oreskes.
Oh, yes. I do know Naomi.
UCSD. It's coming out soon.
Okay, I think...
I'm supposed to write them a jacket comment. I don't even have time to read it. I just had dinner with her when I was down at AAAS. She basically shows that some of the same architects of climate disinformation were, in fact, including Fred Singer and Fred Seitz, were in the tobacco disinformation movement earlier. Same people.
Mm-hmm.
Same tactics. Tried and true. And here's our fourth estate falling for it again.
Yeah, that's the very, very disquieting part.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about that extensively in my book.
Yeah.
The one that's never been reviewed by mainstream media. Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing, actually.
It's seven or eight books reviewed all over the place. I haven't seen one review in a newspaper.
And it's topical on top of that.
Right. And it's about the process, including them. I don't think they want to quote the fact that I think that they're a deeply broken institution that has to find its roots. I don't really want to hear that.
Yeah, well, if that's the case, then it's sad.
Well, that's I say that.
Yeah.
But the trouble is, I only trust them to do it. I do not trust the blogsters.
No, I agree.
Because yeah. blogsters are, by and large, elliptical. And they're only read by their own people. And not read by the others.
Yeah, that's...
It has to find its roots.
Yep.
Again, we need them. My criticisms are not out of anger. They're out of love.
Mm-hmm.
We need them.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, I'm pretty damn angry that they put money ahead of truth. But, of course, that's not the reporters. That's their management. But I don't see them organizing unions to fight their management.
No.
I don't mean unions for salary. I mean unions for truth.
This is, and just to jump back to climate for a minute, this is obviously going to have an impact on whether or not there's any kind of international treaty on climate.
Or national.
Or national.
Without a U.S. agreement, there's not going to be much international. Why do you think these guys in the forces of darkness are trying to do this? Mm-hmm. Because if they can keep the U.S. from doing anything by lying, cheating, spin-doctoring, and not being assaulted in the media, then that's going to poison the waters in the international group when the largest accumulator emitter, the United States, is not doing its own due diligence.
Yeah, pretty simple game in a way. Just make sure one of them, the U.S. doesn't...
This is all about market share and timing. These guys know they've lost the war. We're right, scientifically. They're wrong. That's demonstrated, in my opinion, beyond a reasonable doubt. So all they have to do is character assassination, innuendo, catch some errors, reframe the debate in a false frame, capture the media to cover it, throw everybody into confusion, delay 2 years, and maybe get back one House of Congress and then completely kill America's action for the foreseeable future. That's their strategy, and you know what? It's got at least a 50% chance it's going to work. Again. They did it in 92, and they're doing it again. It's all in science of the contact sport, except not the recent incarnation. This is so much worse than I said in my book. It's all the same elements, but it's even worse because it's hard for us to get a hearing out there. The media is so locked into false balance.
Well, I thought we were over the false balance thing a year ago.
Well, have you seen a media story yet? Seth Bornstein.
Yeah.
He did say that the actual errors are really pretty small out of the batting average. But he didn't. That was not in his lead. That was two-thirds of the way down in the article.
Hmm.
And that could very well have been done by his editors.
Yeah.
Not Seth.
Yeah.
That's the one mainstream story I saw. And the New York Times and Washington Post wrote editorials where they said the errors were trivial. 12 weeks too late. Finally.
Finally, yeah.
12 weeks. Let's face it, this is a great man-bites-dog story. The temple of high science caught in error.
Mm-hmm.
That is a good story. I'm not against them covering it. But you've got to put in the same story, the batting average, and the batting average of every other way to know. What's Inhofe's batting average? Zero.
Zero.
Yeah, he strikes out and gets in the Hall of Fame.
Well, partially what we're losing is this idea of objective truth. Everything's become opinion now.
There's no such thing in science. What I keep saying in all my talks is, can we please get rid of this stupid, meaningless phrase, exact science? There's no such thing.
Yeah.
We approximate truth. And when we have so many experiments that it's not worth checking anymore, like gravity or the greenhouse effect, we declare it well established and move on to competing explanations and speculative components because it's foolish to sit and continuously reinvestigate what we know. And they then claim, oh, but they've reinvestigated and found it flawed. Almost all their arguments are deeply flawed, demonstrably flawed, shown to be flawed, and all they do is keep repeating them. And then they get the ditto heads. And the Tea Partiers to repeat them and then send ugly four-letter word-laced death threat-ish emails to us for intimidation, feeling that they're doing their patriotic duty by doing this. I have hundreds.
I would think you do now, and I know mine has increased as well, and you're a much higher profile.
You know, you worry because these are the gun-toters, whether one of them is like that lunatic who flew into the building. I mean, you got to worry about those guys.
Yeah.
We are vulnerable to that.
Well, let's hope it doesn't come to pass, that's for sure.
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, they shoot abortion doctors. I mean, when you're deranged and ideological in a gun-toting country, that's not a great thing. Fortunately, the probability for any one individual will be dramatically low, probably lower than you're getting in a car crash, so I'm not going to sit there and let it affect me. But, you know, it's going to happen.
Who wants to be in there?
A lunatic is not promoted to tenure and comes in and shoots your colleagues?
True.
The postal worker syndrome?
And that says, why would you want to be a scientist on the IPCC now?
Well, don't think that we haven't been getting young people asking, should I really risk this? I've got to go because I have somebody coming. Anything else we need to talk about?
No, I think that's it. It's good to chat again. And
go out and fight. We need everything we can get.
I guess I got to be busy again. Yeah, okay.
Yep. Go for it.
All right, you too.
Take care.
All right, bye.
Thanks. Bye.
That was Stephen H. Schneider talking with Stephen Leahy. Find links to Schneider's webpage in my Radio EcoShock blog dated March 11th. And you'll find links to Stephen Leahy's IPS article titled Violent Backlash Against Climate Scientists, as published in the Tierra America Network, hundreds of papers on March 8th. Canadian climate scientist and IPCC contributor Dr. Andrew Weaver told Leahy, "We're in a bizarre time, powered by greed and fear. The general public is more confused than ever. And good scientists are saying to themselves, why would I want to participate in the IPCC? The newspaper world, my friends, is falling into bankruptcy due to debt-laden mergers and acquisitions, competitions from free information on the Internet, and a general move from print to audio and video. Hordes of good reporters have lost their jobs, and would you believe it, newspapers tend to let environment reporters go first. What a surprise. Are they protecting their big business advertisers? No, no, of course not. It's just coincidence. You can help. Stephen Leahy may be the new model, a journalist who works directly for his or her readers. Stephen is off on a whirlwind tour of three continents, covering conferences ranging from forestry to the sickening oceans. He's your reporter, but Stephen needs your help to keep going. Please visit his webpage at stephenleahy.net, where you can adopt an environmental journalist with a small donation by PayPal. Steve has two kids to feed, and we need to keep him going. Stephen has a PH in it, and Leahy is spelled Leahy.net. Do it. I've been reading about harassment and death threats to climate scientists most recently in that five excellent part series by Clive Hamilton. The most recent installment, published in Scientific American, has the subject head, "Researchers must purge email boxes daily of threatening correspondence, simply part of the job of being a climate scientist," end quote. This is the last gasp of the fossil fuel age. The men who make billions every quarter, they can keep this thing going the longer they can stall. They're buying whoever they can in the media, the blogosphere, and the houses of government. And this is all tied into a long-standing conspiracy that goes deeper than mere money. It finds a home in libertarians and ideologues who fear big government or they hate it. A recent report by the Southern Poverty Law Center says disgruntled Americans are being whipped up by well-known media figures like Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh. Somehow, in muddled minds, the science of climate change has been deftly attached to 9/11, unemployment, and the new extreme patriot groups. The report is called Rage on the Right. The militias, the gun nuts, and the haters are back. They fly planes into the IRS or attack the Pentagon single-handed. Both Leahy and Schneider worry it's just a matter of time before a climate scientist is shot as well. I hope they are so wrong. But just imagine the coming madness of crowds after a series of strange climatic events, after a heat wave kills thousands, after a megastorm wipes out another city, after the crops fail again. Our picture of society may fall off the wall as anger takes over. We'll now go to the real conspiracy, three scientists who frightened the world, who morphed from cold warriors into anti-environmentalism, the founders of the current climate denialism, the institute they founded, named after World War II warrior General George C. Marshall, took tobacco money and then oil money to stop government action, to endanger millions of lives and future generations. We'll get the story from the author of a new book, Merchants of Doubt, how a handful of scientists obscure the truth about climate change. Naomi Oreskes is a professor of history and science studies at the University of California, San Diego. She spoke at the University of Rhode Island on March 2, 2010. You're going to hear a fairly long clip from that speech. Find the whole thing on the Climate 2010 page of our website, ecoshock.org. This is Naomi Oreskes.
In the book, we track the story of a small handful of Cold War physicists, a relatively small number of people who had a big impact because they were powerful and influential, and because they, through their Cold War work, you know, were known by admirals and generals and senators and governors, and even were invited to the White House to brief presidents because they were very influential and important people. But instead of promoting the results of their own scientific colleagues' work, instead they promoted the idea of doubt, of the exploitation of scientific uncertainty to avoid regulatory action on a set of issues, as I've said, ranging from tobacco control to global warming. So there are three principal players in the story and one think tank. The three principal players are these men shown here. On the left, Robert Jastrow, an astrophysicist who was the head of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies. So you see these were all extremely prominent people, and that's part of the story. If they hadn't been prominent, I don't believe they would have had credibility with the mass media. They wouldn't have had access to the corridors of power, but they did. In the middle, Frederick Seitz, the former president of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, president of the Rockefeller University, and also a consultant to the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. And on the right, this man, known to quite a few people in this audience, William Nirenberg, a nuclear physicist and the longtime director of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Well, you never liked those guys anyway, right? And the think tank is the think tank that these three men founded in 1984, the George C. Marshall Institute. They founded the Marshall Institute originally to defend Ronald Reagan's strategic defense initiative against the scientist boycott of it. Some of you will remember that in the early 1980s, when Ronald Reagan first proposed the idea of strategic defense or Star Wars, there was a massive reaction against it by physicists and engineers who thought that it would be politically destabilizing and was generally a bad idea. Jastrow, Nirenberg, and Seitz were part of a small minority of physicists who supported SDI and wanted to create a mechanism to counterbalance the publicity that mainstream physicists were getting in the mass media. And so they created the Marshall Institute in order to get their views heard and by demanding equal time from the media. So when the media quoted Carl Sagan and Hans Bethe and many other physicists saying SDI is a bad idea, it will be destabilizing, it could provoke the very first strike that it's supposedly intended to prevent, these men would call up newspapers and say, well, excuse us, but we want equal time for our views. And they got it. So from 1984 to 1989, for about 5 years, they spent most of their time, and Nirenberg and Seitz were retired, Jastrow was retired at this point too. They were all retired from the jobs they had had for most of their careers, and they dedicated themselves to defending SDI, and they did this, and this is one of the, this story is filled with paradoxes and ironies. Later they would accuse environmentalists of being alarmists, but they themselves defended SDI by promoting an extremely alarming view of Soviet strength, a view that was later shown to be quite incorrect, and a very alarming view of American weakness. So just to give you one example of the kind of alarmism that they promoted, in 1987, Robert Jastrow published this article in the National Review under the title, America Has 5 Years Left. I mean, as alarmist as Al Gore and Jim Hansen have ever been, I don't think they ever said we only have 5 years left to deal with global warming. But in this article, he insisted that the Soviet was about to overtake us in military strength, and that unless we improved our military capacity immediately, within 5 years, the Soviet Union would overtake us, dominate Europe, dictate terms in the Middle East, and essentially take over the world. Well, that didn't turn out to be true. At the time, Fred Seitz was working as a consultant to the R.J. Reynolds Corporation. And as many of you know, and has been written about in several books, including a wonderful book by Alan Brandt, professor at Harvard, called The Cigarette Century, the principal strategy that the tobacco industry used to defend tobacco against the mounting scientific and medical evidence of its harms was what we refer to in our book as doubt mongering. That is to say, to insist over and over and over again that the science was unsettled, that we didn't really know, that there were very substantial scientific uncertainties, and that therefore it was premature for the government to act to control tobacco. We just didn't know, was their mantra. So in 1989, these two strands, the Cold War defense of SDI and Seitz's work with the tobacco industry, merged. Now, 1989 is not a coincidental year because, as some of you will remember, it's also the year that the Cold War ended. Soviet Union fell apart, and shortly after, the Berlin Wall fell. So you might have thought that Jastrow and Seitz and Nirenberg, whose whole reason, the raison d'etre for the Marshall Institute, the whole reason they had come together to create this institute was to defend the United States against the Soviet threat. Well, suddenly there was no Soviet threat. And these men were all, by this point, in their late 70s or even early 80s. They'd had very successful scientific careers. So you might have thought that they might have said, great, we won the Cold War. Life is good. Let's retire and play golf. It's not what they did. Instead, they found a new enemy. And that new enemy was what they called environmental extremism, what they considered to be the exaggeration of environmental threats and the insistence that government regulation was needed to control these threats. So basically, they began to take on a set of environmental issues, starting with acid rain, then the ozone hole. They became engaged in a big argument in the mid-90s about secondhand smoke, and finally global warming. And then later they actually returned to an old argument about DDT. So these are, in the book we have a chapter on each of these debates. In every single case, these men denied the severity of the problem, And in every single case, they insisted that the science was too uncertain to justify government intervention in the marketplace. And I think this is really important because I think it begins to show an important pattern. It could be that the science of the ozone hole was uncertain. That might have been the case. It could have been true. I'm not saying it was, but it could, in theory, have been true. But acid rain and ozone and tobacco and global warming, it was always the same argument. No matter what the science was, no matter who the scientists were, no matter what agency was funding it, these men always attacked it as insufficient. They always used the tobacco strategy. And they always said that it would be wrong for the government to interfere in the marketplace to control the threat. So as I said, this was the strategy developed by the marketplace, developed by the tobacco industry. And in fact, there's a very infamous memo that has been cited now in a number of books that goes like this. Doubt is our product, since it is the best means of competing with the, quote, body of fact that exists in the minds of the general public. So this was written by a tobacco industry executive in 1969, and this was the strategy that was then applied to all these other campaigns. So this is why we call it doubt mongering. We call the book Merchants of Doubt, because it was all about using this play from the tobacco playbook to use doubt to make people feel that it would be too soon to act on a problem. But none of that would have been credible. I mean, most of us are smart enough to realize the tobacco industry executives have a vested interest, right? So the tobacco industry understood that for these claims to be credible, they had to be supplied by scientists. And so the tobacco industry, going back to the 1950s, hired scientists to do this work. And Frederick Seitz was one of their important people who did this. And he brought that strategy then into these other debates. Obviously, for the details, you can read the book. But I want to just spend a few minutes now talking about why we fell for it. Why has this strategy been so effective again and again and again over the course of the 50 years? The tobacco industry began doing this in 1954. That's before I was born and before any of you guys were born, right? It's a long time ago. This has been going on for half a century. So why did we fall for it and why do we keep falling for it? But we also fell for it, we argue, because we have a wrong view of science. Because we've been taught a wrong view of science in school and in our textbook. And that wrong view is that we think that science provides proof. We expect science to provide proof. And therefore, when someone raises doubts, when someone says, oh, but there's this little thing over here that isn't resolved, or there's this question here that people are still uncertain about, or a scientist says, well, it's complicated, right? Then we think that there's something wrong with the science. But what we want to argue is that there's nothing wrong with the science. And in fact, it's what's right with the science, that science, the normal process of doing scientific research, involves engaging with doubt, engaging with uncertainty, but working through it.
So there is the real conspiracy. Not by climate scientists to take over the world, but by industry hacks and Cold Warrior ideologues to keep us upset and stupid while the world burns. Beware the doubters and deniers. But that was history. Now in 2010, the anti-science belief system, sprouted by three American scientists, has grown into a cult, for now, and threatens to become a popular movement. Nature and physics don't care what you believe. What is coming will come. I'm Alex Smith. Write me anytime, radio@ecoshock.org.
In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if a woman can't survive, they may I'm gonna need your teeth more.